anybody knows the inner workings of the celebrity industrial complex, it's Lanny Jones. For nearly a decade, he managed People magazine, making it the highest-selling print magazine in the country. Then he went on to edit Money magazine, which won 3 consecutive national magazine awards. He popularized the term baby boom in his 1980 book, Great Expectations, America and the Baby Boom Generation. And in 2023, he published the subject of our discussion today, a book aptly entitled Celebrity Nation, How America Has Evolved into a Culture of Fans and Followers. Want to know what a celebrity is, how this all began, where it's going, and what it's actually like to be famous? Give this episode a good old-fashioned listen on your morning commute, at the gym, or anywhere else. As always, the 27 Rouge team wishes you well. Good night. Mr. Jones, thanks so much for coming on to the show.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you, Scott.
So I just want to start off by winding back the clock a little bit and talking about how you got interested in all of this. I read in the book, you know, you were part of the Daily Princetonian as an undergraduate. I also was a part of the Daily Princetonian my freshman and sophomore year, or maybe it was just my freshman year. But could you give us some of the cliff notes on how you got interested in some of this stuff leading up to your time at People?
Well, like many of us, I had childhood heroes and celebrities I admired, and they were typically baseball players or athletes of some kind. Mm-hmm. Then when I got to oral singers, I liked Chuck Berry, I liked Tina Turner, from my native St. Louis. But when I got to Princeton, I wondered about trying out for the Daily Princetonian. Mm-hmm. And the editor said, okay, well, why don't you go interview Malcolm X? He's coming to coming to Princeton tomorrow.
Yeah.
he was coming to the Firestone Library at a panel discussion of a small group. And so I said, well, he's not going to want to meet me. He's not going to want to meet a white privileged Ivy League kid. And this is somebody I thought of as a terrorist, you know, who thought white people were evil. So what was illuminating was when I met him, I was completely wrong. He couldn't have been better. He couldn't have been more decent. He was a professorial. He was informative. He was genuinely a gentleman. And so it was my first lesson in celebrity. And if you think you know a celebrity, you don't. And that taught me that. It also taught me I wanted to become a journalist because I thought you can get paid to do this. I mean, this was great. And so that changed things too. So that was the first one. Then I went ahead. I can go ahead and talk about People magazine, but I don't want to drone on too long about that.
No, sure. Maybe just give us some of the cliff notes on your...
I was editor of the University Alumni magazine. And then when some friends of mine started People magazine at Time Incorporated, Time Life, in 1974, they called me up and asked me to join, and so I did. And so there, I was in a world that was full of interesting people. We didn't even call them celebrities. We did not use that word. Right. We thought they were just unusually interesting people. They could be athletes, politicians. They could be anybody. And then I eventually became the editor of People, and I got more involved in all of this. And we used to do focus groups. And the point of a focus group was to see what people wanted to read about. And the focus group moderator would begin it by asking people, who are your heroes? And the people would tick off a list of heroes. And that was always sort of interesting. But then she stopped asking that question. And then I said to her, well, why don't you ask about heroes anymore? And she said, because they can't think of any. That was an aha moment, because everyone had said when I was meeting, you know, Princess Diana, Malcolm X, and Elizabeth Taylor, all these big Ronald Reagan, all these sort of A-list celebrities, you should write a book about it. But I didn't want to write a name-dropping book, which is dopey. And so I wanted to write a more or less serious book about the phenomenon of celebrity and what it was doing to our country. And right. So when the focus group moderator said people could not name heroes, that's that there was a dichotomy between celebrities and heroes, and that the celebrities were winning a battle with heroes. And more as more celebrities arrived, they were taking out the airspace for heroes. And so that led, next thing you knew, I was doing research into the history of celebrity and realizing it sort of began with the Greek gods and, the hero with a thousand faces. It goes back to a timeless sort of narrative in human history. And so I figured out that the first really famous mortal was Alexander the Great. So why was he the first famous one? I mean, previously people had idealized the Greek gods, Odysseus or someone, and they thought they were the heroes and treated them with reverence, and they were like celebrities. So there was a human need to identify celebrities that then transferred to Alexander the Great. Why? Because his face was on a coin. This was the first mortal face to be put on a coin. And there was a link there with technology. That was a technology that made Alexander the famous, Alexander the Great famous. And that continued, through the Middle Ages with the first illustrated manuscripts. There were books with print books, with illustrations on print books. And it goes on and on and on through newspapers, newsreels, next is movies, Hollywood movies. So I write about all these phenomena, then television, then reality television, creating celebrities out of the ethosphere. They had no accomplishments and they became famous. And then finally now we're sort of stuck with social media in which people are famous and we don't know why. A great definition of the word celebrity, which is not so easy to define, was by Daniel Boorstin, the Librarian of Congress in 1961, in a book he wrote called The Image. And he said, a celebrity is a person known for their well-knownness, known for being well-known and famous for being famous. And that was it. So the fact of being well-known carried the day. And that's what we're stuck with now, where celebrity is completely divorced and separate from accomplishment. And so that's sort of the cliff notes. I write about a lot of people in the book, who have various forms of celebrity. One of the things, one of the things that you notice is that a characteristic of celebrities really for a long time has been defiance. The more defiant and unconventional you are, the more famous you become. And so we saw this with Oscar Wilde. We saw this in a way with John Keats. We saw this with Calamity Jane. We saw it with Hickok. We saw it a little bit with him. Buffalo Bill Cody. Yeah. Buffalo Bill. They were defiant. And Sarah Bernhardt, the actress, another defiant celebrity who sort of reveled in their unconventionality. And so that continued, and that brings us all the way up to someone like Donald Trump, a politician whose main characteristic is his defiance.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. You mentioned Joseph Campbell, who, obviously wrote The Hero with a Thousand Faces. And I found that thesis to be fascinating, and it challenged me to reconsider how story is crafted. And once you kind of see something in one context, you can't stop seeing it in other contexts. Just the Joseph Campbell book. But going back to some of the things you discuss in the book, just in terms of defining terms here, how would you describe the celebrity industrial complex? I mean, how did all of this start and what did it become? Let's just start the term celebrity industrial complex. What are the mechanisms at play? What is it? What are the mechanisms at play here? It sounds like from what you've described, a lot of the infrastructure for this is baked into, you know, thousands of years of human civilization, going back to, you know, Alexander the Great and just how we organize ourselves in a society. But could you talk a little bit about the celebrity industrial complex?
Sure. The machinery that makes it work is a collaboration between the media, the means of communication, and nowadays, of course, it's called social media is a prominent one, and the media and the marketers, people who have something to sell. So they pay the media to do it. And what do they want? They want eyeballs. And so anybody that can get them eyeballs, it works. And so the celebrities can get them eyeballs. And so it's a combination of a conspiracy between the marketers, the media, the celebrities themselves, who are anointed as celebrities, and the willing consumers who buy it. And so they're the eyeballs that are delivered. And so it's all of those things coming together, media, marketers, celebrities, and a willing public that makes the celebrity industrial complex so powerful. I was thinking of it just recently, reading about Prince Harry and his lawsuit against the British tabloids. And I mean, in a way, he wants to have it both ways. He wants to be a celebrity and take advantage of it and do interviews on Oprah and sell bestsellers to the public with a ghostwriter. But then he also is a critic of it, and a very, very vehement critic of what the media has done to him. And so it made him into an object that was an object sold on the media to the public. And so it's a pretty good example of the closed circuit that the celebrity industrial complex, or the closed cycle of the celebrity industrial complex.
But I mean, now, you alluded to TikTok stores earlier. These are not people who are being covered necessarily by tabloids. I've interviewed some very well-known internet celebrities, people with, you know, newsletters and you know, millions of Twitter followers, hundreds of thousands of Instagram followers, this kind of thing. And yet they're not the people showing up in the New York Times feature section, or even the New York Post for that matter. One guy in particular, Sahil Bloom, who was on this show, he writes a newsletter that has hundreds of thousands of subscribers. He's got tons of Twitter followers. I think he might have more than a million. I honestly don't know. I don't use Twitter, but he's a internet guy, and he's well known in the spheres of the internet. But he was able to do that without the mouthpiece of tabloids. So, I mean, it's also a change in technology, I think, or a change in the kinds of media that people consume, really. But I don't know. That's just something that came to mind. You don't need tabloids to become a celebrity anymore. There's the people shaking.
Who called him a celebrity because of his exposure on the internet?
Would I call him a celebrity? I don't know. That depends how we define the term, of course.
So he's obviously well known in a special field. I don't know. To me, these celebrities are widely known by almost everybody. So it's face recognition.
Yeah.
And face recognition is important here. And name, going back to Alexander the Great, and name recognition. And it's the sort of reverence people give to these people. I mean, one of the things I did was I looked up the roots of the word celebrity. And it comes to celebrant, but pretty soon it becomes is celebrated as a Catholic priest in a mass who convenes a mass, and it's the link between people and the divine. And so the celebrity is there. So a person can celebrate a mass, but also a widow can celebrate her husband's funeral. And so it was just sort of funny. But it's a, an innate human characteristic to do that link with the divine and the reverential that somehow is splashed over, splashed out of the tub and embraced celebrities with it, what we now call celebrities.
Yeah, you know, actually, I'm in Paris right now, and the word for single in French is célibataire. Like, interestingly, a single meaning unpartnered. You don't have a wife or a husband. And I mean, perhaps there's something to the root about standing alone, not being together with the rest of the people, with another person, with other people. Like, the idea that being single is the celebrity has to maybe stand alone. Some kind of, you know, like you have to stand alone to watch the crowd kind of thing. You talked about defiance earlier. I wonder if in the etymology of the word, there's something there. We'd have to look it up, perhaps.
Well, I agree. I can't really add much more to what you said. But,
So talk to me a little bit about heroes and celebrities, and how in America we've come to conflate the two, perhaps. Is it that because we are devoid of heroes, we turn to celebrities as people up to whom we can look? Or how did the two become conflated within popular American imagination?
Yeah, it's something like that. They're filling the gap. I write about this in my book, and if you don't mind, I'll just mention what I say about it.
No, please. Please do.
So I say a bunch of definitions. A hero is distinguished by achievement. The celebrity is distinguished by image or trademark. The hero creates fame by extraordinary actions and achievements. The celebrity is created by the media, as I just said. The hero is a big person. The celebrity is a big name. And that's a distinction. Now, this is getting very important. The hero represents community values, and the celebrity stands for individual values. Mm. And one of the things I looked at a number of scholarly studies about celebrity culture, and believe it or not, celebrity studies is a burgeoning academic discipline these days.
I didn't know that.
What I found out is that the more a person is a celebrity worshiper, the less involved they are in community activities, the less likely they are to vote, less likely they are to join a community organization. So,
say that one more time. The more involved in celebrity, people or celebrities?
The more a celebrity worshiper and in the celebrity, you know, atmosphere, the less involved they are in the community and voting and joining voluntary activities and so on. So it promotes the individual, but not the community.
Interesting.
Yeah. I mean, it's important. Now, I say this, the hero is sacrificing. The hero sacrifices for others. The celebrity is selfish, only in it for themselves. And an important one, the passage of time enlarges the hero. The passage of time diminishes the celebrity. So over time, the celebrity lose something too, you know, over 10 years.
This is fascinating.
That's my summary of the difference between them. I want to say more because I would like to hope that the everyone is beginning to see the weaknesses of the celebrity culture and looking for ways to talk about heroes and to celebrate, quote, celebrate heroes more than they are now.
I think there certainly has been a rise of heroes, particularly for young men, young, somewhat, you know, I wouldn't say always disaffected, but like the phenomenon of Jordan Peterson, if you're familiar with him, or David Goggins is another one. Jocko Willink is another one. they're these hyper masculine influencers, I guess, who talk to people. They tell people to work out, to go to the gym, to employ discipline in all aspects of their life. And they're sort of, they've positioned themselves as attacking or confronting the crisis of masculinity, or what they perceive to be a crisis of masculinity in America and in the West, more largely. So that, I mean, that, but these people again wouldn't fit the idea of, like, I mean, I know who Jocko Willink and David Goggins are, and most of my listeners probably know who they are as well. But they're not celebrities in the sense that they're not, you know, Hollywood actors. They're, you don't see them in lots of pictures. They're not in the tabloids.
Paid? Somebody paying them, a sponsor, a marketer who is paying them to do this.
Yes.
So that's the machinery of it. That's more of the machinery that pays the social influencers. And so, you know, I mean, the ones that are familiar to me are the older ones, like Kim Kardashian, you know, Paris Hilton.
Yeah.
Who are basically paid for their defiance and then become celebrity influencers because they have an audience. And they have no achievement, but they have an audience.
Well, Kim Kardashian made a sex tape. You could call that an achievement.
That's how they became famous. That's another thing.
I'm joking. I guess I was using the examples of these guys to illustrate that they're filling themselves. They're more heroes to a lot of young men than celebrities. They fall more into the hero category. Like, you see an 18-year-old kid saying, I want to be like him. So that's the point I was just trying to make on that. But I mean, on the subject of peering into people's lives, I mean, Paris Hilton is an interesting example. Britney Spears is another one. Kim Kardashian. I mean, Britney Spears was a singer, but on the subject of the appeal and attraction of celebrity, I, especially today in the 21st century, it seems that there's something that this has something to do with living vicariously through other people. Like, people have normal lives. They have 9-to-5 jobs. They have families. They have mortgages and, you know, car payments and all of this kind of things. And they see these celebrities doing incredible things, you know, and they think to themselves, I could be like them, or they sort of take a break from the monotony of everyday life. And they kind of live vicariously through the celebrities in a way that's almost voyeuristic. I mean, what would you say about this vicarious living and then this voyeurism of, like, peering into other people's lives? I mean, they're distinct, right? Like, the vicarious living, I guess, is I could be like them. And then the voyeurism is sort of this weird, slightly perverted human tendency to want to know what other people are doing, to want to be let in on the most private aspects of other people's lives. And the weird part is that these aren't even people that you know. They're strangers. So what would you say on the subject of voyeurism or vicarious living?
You phrased it very well there. I tried to look at my book at this a little bit. And what you come up against is what a psychologist would call a parasocial relationship. And these are all parasocial relationships. And what's that? Well, it means a relationship that's a one-way street, where there's you feel a degree of intimacy with someone, and in this case, celebrities, and but that they don't know you. So it's a one-way street. But people buy into it, and so they have a parasocial relationship. Sometimes there's an element of, my German is terrible, Schadenfreude in it.
Yeah.
So you take pleasure in their problems, and you like to talk about it. But that's really all it is. It just becomes a method of talking about it. I remember when People Magazine, when I was the editor, we had a lot of covers about Princess Diana. Mm-hmm. And, who I actually met at one point, two points. But I was going to interview Bill and Hillary Clinton in Little Rock when he was running for president. And I bought a copy of, just off the presses, of a cover of Paper with Princess Diana on it. And the cover said something like, you know, the Battle of the Whales and her marital problems. And so I handed it to Hillary Clinton, and she took it and she held it up in the light. And she said, first thing I ever heard her say was, oh, they never should have married so young. And so she had an opinion about Princess Diana, you know, who she did not know and who did not know her, but it did not stop her from having an opinion about Princess Diana's personal life.
In a kind of parasocial way. I mean, yeah. I understand this, the parasocial relationship very well. I myself, while an undergrad at Princeton, published a memoir about my own life, including my time at Princeton. Uh-huh. And I think there's certainly, there's better things you could read, but there's certainly something to be said about people who don't know you thinking that they know you. I mean, you started this, I don't consider myself to be a celebrity, but you started this interview by saying, if you think you know a celebrity, you're wrong. And I think that with TikTok and Instagram and all of the other conduits for publicity nowadays, people do feel that they know these others because the others are talking directly to them on the phone, on a personal device. Every day, they're using words like you. I mean, I do some of this as well. And I just wonder if that doesn't come with some certain kinds of consequence. I mean, I think it comes with positive and negative consequences. Of being able, if you have a really positive message, then you can reach more people with that message. But the parasocial relationship is interesting, and I think it's characteristic of a lot of how social media is engaged with today. I don't know, and this is towards the end of your book that you talk about this.
Yeah, one of the people who seems to generate a lot of this, and you may know it better than me, is Taylor Swift.
Yeah.
No, she's wildly popular.
Yeah.
And people feel, I'm not quite sure of the reason, but maybe the lyrics of her songs and the message, they feel a certain intimacy with her. And which I find sort of fascinating and would like to hear more about that. And some of it comes from from young people, but it also comes from older baby boomers and previous generations who likewise feel a certain intimacy with Taylor Swift. So I just, I don't know, she's a good example of that parasocial relationship with a very broad appeal.
Yeah, she is. Well, I mean Taylor Swift is certainly a key example here, but talk to me a little bit about what sells, you know? Like you describe in the book, this kind of authenticity that people crave. Like for example, Johnny Depp, he had you talk about Johnny Depp and Paris Hilton. Both of them had what may have previously been incidents that would be damning to their career, and yet they maintained their celebrity status, and they continue to operate as before. But, you know, so, I mean, is it a kind of like authenticity and vulnerability that when you're like vulnerable and you talk about the incident and apologize for it and such, or what is it about, or Taylor Swift, even she's giving you, I mean, a song is by nature fiction, not necessarily, but you know, she sings all these songs, which are stories. They're kinds of stories, and people feel like they know her because she tells these deeply personal stories in the songs. So is it a kind of vulnerability that's being sold, or how does that come to head with the sort of defiant element that you were describing before?
Yeah. Well, I mean, to understand that, I talked a lot to a Northwestern professor named Dan McAdams, who has studied this, and he calls it for it to work effectively, it's called the redemption narrative, in which the narrative is a person, a celebrity, an accomplished person, well, has a crisis, and you go through the crisis, but then you have to be redeemed, and so you have to apologize, and you admit your sins, you denounce your parents, you admit your sins, and then you say you will be redeemed and you will do better. So people like Johnny Depp, if you look at the bestseller list, about half of the bestsellers these days are written by what I would call celebrities, and they all contain a redemption narrative. You know, this is my life. It was hard. I struggled. I failed. But then I came back and I redeemed. I apologized. The public apology is a big part of the celebrity redemption. And so I did that too. Somewhere in my book, I talk about this. Let me see. Yeah, so there was a person who does this says, I have a special gift. I am seen and moved by the suffering in the world. And this is Sting, Brad Pitt, Angela Jolie. And I believe my destiny is to have a positive impact on others. And I will never abandon those beliefs. So I try to reconcile my strengths and my needs for community. And bad things happen to me, but good outcomes follows. And my suffering is then redeemed. And I expect things I have generated to grow and flourish. And so that's the redemption narrative that you hear again and again in the case of celebrities. Mm. And that was from Dan McAdams. A history professor, Daniel Bell, who I believe you have met, had just published a book called Men on Horseback.
David Bell.
Of modern leadership and military affairs. And so it's about Napoleon and Toussaint Louverture and Simon Bolivar and people like that.
Yeah.
But what he notices is that it's very dependent on media and people having access, thinking they know these leaders as personal friends. And that even happened to George Washington. And so when somebody wrote a biography of Washington, everyone thought they knew him as a personal friend. And so he became an untouchable leader. And it happened to Andrew Jackson, of all people, because he was a military leader. And then he ran he was in effect a celebrity. And then he ran for president. And how did he get out of nowhere? And how did he get away with this? Well, because the newspapers were just then being invented. And so there were hundreds of newspapers for the first time in an American election. And Andrew Jackson got together with the people who owned the newspapers to get them behind him. And that's how and in a large degree, how he became president.
That's fascinating. I didn't know that. There's a media machine at play. Jackson's a fascinating episode in American history. The Jacksonian era. I remember learning about it for the first time in AP US history. But look, I want to be respectful of your time here, so I'm gonna move through the last couple of questions, if that's okay.
Oh, that's fine.
I want to talk about the line between reality and performance. You know, we've discussed before how we don't really know celebrities, and you know, the Malcolm X example of, you thought that he was going to be brash and wouldn't be particularly excited to talk to you, but in fact he was a perfect gentleman, and you know, spoke very eloquently, and articulately, and so, you know, there's this thing about how we think we know a celebrity, but we don't. But then there's also something about the line between reality and performance. I think of, you know, I'm in France right now. So, I mean, 18th century France is on my mind. In 18th century France, there was a big discussion about private and public lives. People would, I mean, this is a bit of an oversimplification, but they could behave badly in private as long as their public honor and virtue was maintained. What this often meant for men was that they could philander and have mistresses and concubines and whatnot privately, as long as publicly they were, you know, like a happily married, you know, family man, man of honor. Women also, you know, if women were to explore their sexuality in 18th century France, that was not looked kindly upon by polite society. So long as you know, people found out about it. If they didn't find out about it, then it was, you know, it was okay. So, I mean, they had rather primitive methods of birth control. I read about one, or I heard about one, of using like a chicken's liver as a kind of makeshift IUD. Or using chicken's blood. People would use chicken's blood to put on their sheets on their marriage night. The idea was back then that you would bleed the first time you had sex, but if women had, which we know now is not always the case, but, you know, the people would basically bring fake blood to put on the sheets to ensure that it was their first time, you know, to like, so that the maid or whatever would find it. Anyway, the point of all of this is basically just that there has, for various points of history, been a dichotomy between one's private life and one's public life. And I think the same is true of celebrities. Celebrities, actors in particular, they're playing a role even when the cameras aren't rolling. When they go out to restaurants and whatnot, they're playing the role of, in some cases, the celebrity. You mentioned Kim Kardashian, Paris Hilton. So talk to us a little bit about the line between reality and performance. Does the performance ever end, or only in the confines of the home? But anytime you're out in public, it's performance.
Well, that's a fascinating topic. It's a book in itself, is when that these lines were first starting to break down. As you were talking about France, I was thinking about Jean-Jacques Rousseau, writer, philosopher, who was one of the first to encounter what you're talking about. He thought he could write his books as a performance and no one would bother him personally. Yeah. But then he went to play chess in the Tuileries or something. He was besieged by, in effect, autograph seekers, and he was appalled that this could possibly happen. He was one of the first people to write about this happening. And it had something to do with the book. It's a technology that spread his name around. And then as you were continuing to talk, I continued to think about recent examples. For some reason, we just read that Françoise Gillot died. And she had been mistress of Picasso. But the public somehow was more forgiving of Picasso than they were of Françoise Gillot, who stirred up a great controversy when she talked about it. In my own experience, I had met Ronald Reagan, the president, for a meeting in the cabinet room of the White House. And it was on the American Family. And he went around the room and asked everyone for an opinion about the future of the family. And so it must have been maybe 8 or 10 people there. So we all talked for 5 minutes each. It was something we thought was important. And then when they got to Reagan, to summarize it, he ignored everything everybody said and simply told one of his campaign stories about a welfare mother driving Cadillacs in the Riviera or something. And so that was Reagan being Reagan. And he was a performer. He came from television and movies and Death Valley days. And he was he and Andrew Jackson were the first celebrities to attain the presidency. And then it was the line with Reagan. I don't know. we did not find all that much about his personal life. Where we did, and the person I call the godmother of celebrity, is Betty Ford, the wife of the President Gerald Ford, who talked publicly about her drug problems, her alcoholism, talked about her husband, her sex life with her husband. She talked about her daughter and was her, and she said it would be fine with her if her daughter wasn't a virgin. And these were unconventional opinions from a politician, where we were used to them keeping that all a secret. But she did not keep it a secret. She talked about it. And at the time, we thought, well, that was a good thing, because she was, you know, she would destigmatize some things that needed to be destigmatized and talk about them. But it opened the doors for journalists to report on the private lives of not just the public lives of politicians, really. And so that's what we're living with that still.
Unfortunately, or I mean, I don't know if it's unfortunate or not, but it seems to produce more negative outcomes than positive outcomes, mm-hmm. that we are so hung up on the intimate details, because there's no line, right? It's not just, oh, I want to know who this person is dating. It's, I want to know about this person's, you know, every detail about them. Yeah. Which is, I mean, it's an affront to privacy to begin with, but it's an affront also to kind of decency. People will share what they're comfortable sharing. Then again, I mean, one could argue that we are entitled to know about the private affairs of somebody who's holding the highest office in the United yeah. States, because it's somehow relevant to us. You know, it speaks to their character. Anyway, what would you say to the kid looking to become famous on TikTok, famous on Instagram, famous in pictures, in films or whatever? What would you say to the 20-year-old kid or 18-year-old kid who dreams of being famous and now has means of getting there with social media? What would you, from a seasoned veteran, someone who's been around celebrities for many years, what would you say to this kid?
Well, I would say guard your privacy, because it's really the most important thing you have, and be careful, because the media is going to grab everything, and so you have to guard your privacy, watch what you say. So it's a conservative approach, and I'm sorry it is in a way, but I think they just have to be very careful with what they say.
Would you caution them against becoming a, I mean, is it, a lot of yes. kids want to be famous, but not for anything in particular.
Becoming a celebrity is one of the worst things that can happen to people, because you lose your privacy. You lose your self-esteem in the end, often, not always, but often, and you lose years of life. The life expectancy of celebrity is about 10 or 15 years lower than that of average Americans. And for a female celebrity, life expectancy is 20 years lower, less than that of most women. And so there's danger out there, and you just have to be aware of it.
I think that's potent. Why do you think that is? Why do they lose their self-esteem?
It's
because they're all constantly being validated.
Media.
Sorry, go ahead.
It's a drumbeat of criticism. You know, social media just wears you down. And you have unrealistic expectations. You think... You get what is called acquired situational narcissism. You become a narcissist if you're a celebrity. And then you want the world to wait on you. But guess what? The world is not always going to wait on you. And if you let that weigh you down, you it's very bad news. So watch out for narcissism is another piece of advice.
Is it possible to be a celebrity who is not narcissistic?
A good question. Yeah, it is. I think it is. If you have a certain integrity of character, and Right. When you're prepared to be disappointed, you're prepared to be close to your friends, you're okay.
Good. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It was a real pleasure.
It was a pleasure. You raised some terrific questions, so I enjoyed talking to you.
I enjoyed talking to you as well.
Good luck.